You are listening to an audio recording of an event hosted by the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C. The event took place on Monday, November 15, 2010, and featured a paper written by Kevin Shepard as part of KEI's academic paper series. The paper was titled, Buying into the Hermit Kingdom, Practices and Implications for Foreign Investment into the DPRK.
Well, first of all, I want to welcome you to Korea Economic Institute. My name is Abraham Kim. I'm the Vice President of KEI, and today is our 38th academic paper series seminar, and I can't believe we've gone through 38 of these, but we've already reached 38. And for some of you who are not familiar with our academic paper series, every year KEI commissions about 10 papers on various aspects of the Korean Peninsula, everything from North Korea issues to foreign relations to sectoral issues to broader global trade issues. And at the end of the year, we compile these papers, we edit it, and we create a volume called the Academic Paper Series, and we distribute it to all of our subscribers. Today, we are very fortunate to have Dr. Kevin Shepard. He comes to us from Hawaii. He's a Kelly Fellow at CSIS Pacific Forum. He's also a research fellow at the Institute for Far Eastern Studies at Kyungnam University. He received his PhD from Kyungnam University on North Korean politics and unification policies, which is not a major you often hear about. But also he holds a graduate degree from the University of Hawaii and Sydney University, and he's published widely on North Korean issues and U.S.-Korea alliance issues. He comes to us today with a very fascinating paper. I had the opportunity to read this, and there's some very interesting stories. And the title of the paper is, of course, Buying into the Hermit Kingdom, FDI in the DPRK. And, of course, I didn't realize there was FDI in DPRK until I read his paper. But despite the fact that North Korea is probably one of the most sanctioned country in the world, the paper provides a revealing account of international investment that are flowing into the DPRK. Dr. Shepard's paper really draws a different picture of North Korea industries and foreign direct investment from the kind of backward, underdeveloped portrayal that the international media often draws picture of North Korea. In fact, there are several pockets of advancement. I think one of the most interesting part is the fact that North Korea has a bustling animation industry. I didn't realize that my kids, by watching Disney's Lion King and myself watching The Simpsons, I was actually supporting North Korean animation industry. But I think Dr. Shepard's paper has some very interesting anecdotes as well as interesting data that he'll be talking about today. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Shepard, and thank you for coming.
All right, thank you. Also, thank you to Ambassador Pritchard and Nicole, who can't be here today, and Sarah, and everyone else who let me come up here and do this today. I'm very happy to be here. Just really tired of that nasty weather out in Honolulu. It's good to be here in D.C. I'm happy to see this many people. I didn't expect this many people to show up, and I recognize some faces, and I recognize some faces of people that know more about this than I, so hopefully I can learn something before I leave here, too. To give you a little bit of background, this paper is a working paper of sorts. There is no specific project that I'm working on. This is sort of a pet project of mine. I became interested in FDI in the North, who's doing it, whether they're making any money, how North Korea differs from other outsource or FDI destinations, and especially what impact it has on the North Korean economy and the North Korean people. My interest, really, it grew out of a book I contributed to that was published last year by Kyungnam University called The Dynamics of Change in North Korea. For that book, most of the information in that book came from defector interviews, but instead of asking them about ideology or what they thought of Kim Jong-il or where they thought succession or unification or things that you see in a lot of defector interviews, we were just asking them about their workplaces and their work habits, their supervisors and how much autonomy they had, how much autonomy the factories or businesses had, and how often these people actually showed up for work, and if anybody cared, or how it is they managed to buy their way into or out of different things, and how familiar they are with local markets and what they thought of officials, things of that nature. And we got a lot of really interesting answers about industry in North Korea and the daily work habits of these ordinary North Koreans and how it had changed over the years. I won't go into too much detail because that's not today's presentation, and because I want you to buy the book. But since then, since that book came out, I've looked at a few other aspects of FDI in North Korea. Over the summer, I gave a paper in Hong Kong in which I advocated FDI as a means to build infrastructure and the economic base in North Korea that I think is necessary to make them confident enough to engage us politically. This being the 20th anniversary of German unification, all the think tanks in South Korea have had something going on this year about German unification and what we can learn, what we need to prepare for, what costs did West Germany incur, what costs did they incur that they had not expected, and how can we look at that and learn from it. But you've got to believe that the North Koreans are studying the East German case. And the people in North Korea in the know, the people that recognize the difference, the huge economic gap between the two Koreas, they're well aware that if unification were to happen today, then they would immediately become second-class citizens. I don't think that they're really game for that. So I think one of the reasons that we see so much brinkmanship and two steps forward and one step back is that because they're afraid of absorption. And so I argued that FDI would be one of the tools to build up the infrastructure and the economic base that would allow them to be a little bit more confident about engaging South Korea and the U.S. and the rest of the international community. I also recently published a paper with the Korea Institute for National Unification in which I looked at whether or not we could possibly influence succession process. Not politically, I don't think we've got much chance of doing that politically, but I thought economically, FDI could be a tool while North Korea is choosing their next set of leaders, and it's not just the son. There are a lot of positions being swapped around in Korea as they build up a base for Kim Jong-un. And if we can be making it very clear the benefits of opening up a little bit to FDI as these people are being swapped in and swapped out, then maybe we could encourage the selection of more technocrats. Maybe we could we could change the minds of some of the people that might see this as an opportunity to open up a bit more, be it to more FDI or to a Chinese or Vietnamese model or whatever it is. In this paper, rather than look at these ideological or these political influences, I wanted to highlight two things. First, I wanted to highlight the diversity of FDI that is already in North Korea. Rather than advocate we do this or encourage that, it's already there. And so I wanted to look at what industries were getting investments and who it was that was investing and why. Now, there is some work on this out there already. Thanks to blogs like NK Econ Watch, North Korea Economy Watch, which I read daily and would recommend to anybody interested in FDI in North Korea or any type of North Korean economic issues. So because of places like that, this isn't totally groundbreaking. But I wanted to learn more about the different industries that people were investing in and to do my part to help dispel this myth of this hermetically sealed North Korea. Yes, it's relatively isolated, but there are channels. Things, trade, information, people do go in and out of this country. And so I just wanted to highlight that. But second, I also wanted to look at the impact that these investments are having directly on the workers in the factories, and also to see what the regime had done in order to satisfy demands of foreign investors, to see what kind of impact this had really had on the business environment and the work environment. So before I get along too far into this, I want to tell you a few things that this paper is not. I'm not an economist. and this is not a number-crunching endeavor. I am interested in, and some of it's in my paper, what companies have done well, what companies have failed, why they've done well, why they've failed. I'm interested in why these people think North Korea is a better destination than, say, China or Vietnam. So I am interested, obviously, in the economic economic parts of this, but I don't have charts, I don't have graphs, I don't have formulas. I'll leave that to the economists. It's also not some sunny, optimistic advocation for FDI in order to save the regime or topple the regime or to feed everyone in North Korea or to, you know, rid North Korea of all human rights violations. I do believe that FDI, if done right, can be beneficial, but I'm also well aware of the limitations. And I do not anywhere in my paper advocate FDI as a source of aid. I'm aware, and there's very little evidence, despite North Korea's occasional and partial economic reforms and reform efforts, there's little evidence that Pyongyang sees any value in fully engaging the international community. From Moscow's attempts to bribe Kim Il-sung to join Comecon to Kim Dae-jung and Noh Moo-hyun trying to buy better inter-Korean relations, North Korea has just shown very little interest in returning our favors in kind. And just last week, last Thursday, I believe, President Obama was in Seoul. He was on Yongsan, and he said, and I quote, "Today, the Korean Peninsula provides the world's clearest contrast between a society that is open and one that is closed, between a nation that is dynamic and growing, and a government that would rather starve its people than change." I don't totally disagree with him. I do, though, think I see some cracks in this closed society. And I think I see some changes underway that the regime cannot control without sheer brute force. Now, I'm fully aware that if the regime decided to use sheer brute force, that the security forces could shut down every market in the country and they could quell every bit of opposition to it. When we hear about opposition to these new market measures that the government has tried to employ, you know, it's the ajumas. It's the 50-year-old women standing at the front of the market demanding that it not be closed. I'm pretty sure the security forces can take them. I think it's interesting that Kim Jong-il's regime has chosen not to go that route. Not everything that's happening in the North Korean economy is going according to plan. And for whatever reason, the government has chosen to let some of these things happen rather than, break out the batons. So I think that's an interesting change that we've been seeing. That's one of the reasons that I'm interested in FDI and what kinds of light it might be able to shed and how it might be able to potentially widen some of these cracks. Also, I see it as an alternative to aid in some cases. In other countries, we hope when we provide aid that not only do people benefit from the aid itself, but the aid workers and their contacts with locals and with officials help to broaden our understanding of what's going on in that country and the people, the society, and the politics. It also provides access to information for those people, access to outside information that locals and authorities and officials might not normally have access to. Unfortunately, that has not really been the case in North Korea. North Korean authorities have been very effective at limiting the contact and therefore the impact that NGOs have had in country. They've gone so far as to shut down aid operations. They've asked foreign workers to leave when they feel like the presence might be a threat. I mean, it's been years, but we learned years ago that Doctors Without Borders does in fact have borders. They pulled out of North Korea because the regime's limitations on what they could do made them, that they decided that they just simply couldn't work effectively in North Korea, and they packed up and went home. On the other hand, though, Pyongyang is increasingly inviting FDI. Kim Jong-il's named 2012 as the year for opening the doors to a strong and prosperous nation. Kim Jong-un, 2 weeks ago, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago, was attributed with having said something to the effect that food is more important than bullets. Oh Guk-yeol and Jang Sung-taek are competing with their foreign investment groups, and these are not These are not groups that are looking to invest outside of North Korea. These are foreign investment groups that are looking to bring foreign investment into the country. Choi Young-nim, the new premier, he was just in China last week, presumably seeking more investment. And so because of things like this, I don't see the door on FDI closing anytime soon. But when I looked at the different types of FDI in North Korea, I broke them down for this paper into three categories. One that I do not support, one that I think will be very influential but not replicable, and then the one that I found most interesting, which was private sector, profit-driven, capitalist, market-based FDI. The first section I'll talk about is South Korean investment. There have been over 300 inter-Korean joint ventures since the first one was launched in 1992. And despite the current tensions, I expect that within a few years this number will start to grow again. And then South Korea is in a unique position. I don't argue that they're not. They're in a unique position in that they have this domestic contingent that calls for engagement. Unification is written into the Constitution of South Korea. And so it's hard for the government not to be involved. But if I were to be advising, then I think the government involvement, from the insurance they provide, the government provides to South Korean companies, to the direct negotiations the government does on behalf of the companies, and just the policy of improving relations and working toward unification, I think this allows North Korea to hold these businesses as political hostages. In addition, most South Korean investment, not all, but most of the South Korean investment is in these special economic zones. And through these, Pyongyang tries to isolate South Koreans and the North Koreans that have contact with them in order to try to get no social or ideological strings attached to the money that Seoul is sending. Now, granted, this has not been entirely successful. Moon pies from Kaesong industrial complex lunchboxes have shown up in markets in Sinijo. So they're not completely isolated. They're also, we've heard rumors from defectors leaving the border region, most of them from the border region, the North Korea-China border region. And there are defectors that have heard about these good jobs down in this industrial complex. So information has leaked out of the Kaesong region and into other parts of North Korea. But by and large, they're pretty isolated. We've also seen North Korea nationalize properties in Kumgangsan, renegotiate rents and wages in Kaesong, just say, I'm sorry, we left some zeros off that. We're not going to use that contract anymore. You all have to go home and renegotiate. But when they do this, it's an indication to me that Pyongyang understands very well that domestic pressure in South Korea will not allow Seoul to let these deals fail at almost any cost. Even you've got Hyundai Asan, which is some of the biggest investment and some of the first investment, absolutely not profit-driven. The sinking of the Chonan caused the South Korean government. This is an act of war, the sinking of a South Korean naval ship. And so the president rolled back in inter-Korean economic exchanges by about 30%. I think Pyongyang's pretty aware, especially with signals like that, that they can hold these hostage and they can renegotiate them as they please, and I don't think that that's a good model. I wouldn't want to invest in a model like that if it was my money I was sending in. So it's because of these tendencies to take these projects hostage and hike up demands that I don't advocate government participation in FDI. Be that as it may, South Korean investments have led to some significant gains both for North Korea and for the investment environment for other foreign investors. South Korean managers, specifically those in the Kaesong Industrial Complex, have said that the quality of labor and the stability of their investments has improved. Says workers are now more willing to work for foreigners. And says one, in North Korea, there's always a free rider problem. And it's not just in North Korea. It's not specific to North Korea, but in any socialist economy, you have people that just don't want to work as hard if there's no incentive to. I've seen satellite pictures of cornfields in North Korea where there's corn planted maybe 5 or 6 feet deep all the way around the edges, and the middle's just empty, and it's just for show. So when the authorities drive down the street, you look like a good socialist farmer. There's no incentive to spend all your time raising the rest of that corn when you could be out, you know, picking berries or making something that you're going to sell on the market. And so people just, there's not that incentive in a socialist economy. But in Kaesong, we've seen people not only asking for overtime, but we've seen them asking for training opportunities. So there has been, you know, some shift in the mindset of some North Korean workers, those that have been in contact with foreign managers. South Korean investment also gets credit for many of the improvements in legal protections, including rights to arbitration, protection of investments, and rights of foreigners who are involved in incidents while within North Korean borders. And to some extent, because of things like this, it's helped to bring some attention to the need for rule of law, although we're not there yet. The second group of investments that I looked at are from China and Russia, mostly from China, but a lot of the Russian investment has similar characteristics, so I put these in the same group. And these investments, they're not burdened with the same type of government involvement and ideological expectations as those in South Korea or from South Korea. But I put them in a separate category because even though they're from private or pseudo-private sector companies, they are generally in line with larger national interests and larger national strategies. And as such, these are underwritten in a number of different ways. So I think that these are going to be very important to North Korea. But because of these underlying national strategies, I don't think this is replicable for Western investors. And the Chinese investment, while important to North Korea, is still relatively small. But the investments that have been made very, very different than the trade that takes place. Much of the exports from China to North Korea are appliances, small motors, plastics, cheap clothing and shoes, things of that nature. But a lot of the investment has been into heavy industry and mining and shipping in particular. I think it's most significant that China's been signing these 50-year land leases for mines, because then they build up not only the mine, but they're building roads to and from and rail to and from, and they're installing generators and things of that nature. That North Korea not only benefits immediately from that infrastructure, but they're most definitely replicating that technology in other places. Russia hasn't, to my knowledge, invested in any significant mining ventures in North Korea, but they have leased rights to Nampo Port and have looked at other ports, just like China, and built roads and rail from the port to the border. And Russia has also shown an interest in running gas pipelines through North Korea, which I think, if that happens, could be significant for North Korea's infrastructure. I think this type of investment's beneficial. I think it's beneficial to North Korea. It's beneficial to peninsular and regional stability, but I don't think it's replicable. And I don't think North Korea will open itself up fully to this type of investment because it's so potentially, it would be so easy to exploit all of North Korea's natural resources. The type of investment that I wanted to focus on that I find most interesting but also most viable is, like I said, market-driven, capitalistic, profit-oriented overseas foreign investment. And it is high risk, it is hit or miss, and it doesn't make up a significant portion of the North's economy. Some people have likened it to investing in China before reforms or in East Germany before unification. And there's one investor, Osler. I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but he's the head of Nosotech, and he's one of the most vocal advocates. He does newspaper interviews and things of that nature regularly and advocates investment in North Korea. He has said that most of these companies are basically into real estate speculation under the guise of joint ventures, and these are just people that expect eventually North Korea will open up, and they want to be the first ones in. Reasonable. Another long-term investor, though, is Felix App. He's been in country for almost a decade, I think since 2002. And he's also the founder of the European Business Association in Pyongyang. I think he's a very interesting example because the things he's done in the North provide examples of why not to invest, of failed investments, of successful investments, but also in how foreign investors can help to improve the investment environment while at the same time empowering technocrats and business people in North Korea. He first went in as the head of the ABB Group. The ABB Group failed and pulled out mainly because of a lack of access to financing. And this is a risk that any company in North Korea faces, mainly due to, one, our efforts to prevent them from having any access to IFIs, and two, because of all the loans that North Korea defaulted on in the 70s and 80s. But now he runs the Pongsu Pharma joint venture company, and it's relatively successful. And in some of the interviews he's given, he says he's met many North Korean authorities. He's found them to be competent, and he says he's been able to work with them to create a stable investment environment. What I found very interesting is that he's brought in lecturers from around the world, throughout the West. He's brought in lecturers to teach business classes. He's set up an MBA-level business training school for North Korean executives and officials. Now, as Abe mentioned, animation is another field that has gained a lot of attention recently, but I thought it was a very, very interesting field of investment. As you mentioned, Pororo. Anybody that knows Pororo has seen joint North-South animation. If you've seen The Lion King, if you've seen Arabian Nights, if you've seen Les Miserables, you've seen North Korean animation. There's a producer named Nelson Shin who was born in North Korea, and he says that the Scientific and Education Film Studio of Korea is one of Pyongyang's biggest earners of foreign capital. And he also said that they employ thousands of, and he said, highly trained animators that turn out cartoons specifically for Western companies. There are other North Korean studios that work with Chinese, Japanese, French, and Italian animators. And that's what I could find. It wouldn't surprise me to find out that there were other animation companies investing in North Korea. And some of these foreign animators have complained about things, everything from slow internet connections to poor management. But they've also pushed Pyongyang to provide better internet access. And it's not just the foreign animators that have access to these computers. It's some of the workers in these animation companies. They've also gotten faster and higher grade computers. Several North Korean websites, Naynara or Orimenjogiri, or you can go to YouTube and Google, and you can see lots of videos and commercials online with these North Koreans happily working away on American-made Dell computers. And part of that is because of these industries that have gone in and demanded that they need this better equipment. There's also at least one animator in a book he wrote when he came out. He noted that animation opportunities that have been provided specifically through foreign investment, because his company had gone in there, they had been able to bring in animators from rural areas that otherwise would have never had an opportunity to move to Pyongyang, would have never had an opportunity to provide for their families that way. So FDI is providing jobs for some people as well. Other investments that I found in North Korea ranged from DHL, ensuring that all your deliveries are on time, several European clothing lines, Singaporean and South Korean fast food, Dutch banks, Egyptian and Vietnamese cell phones, German pharmaceuticals, Japanese firewall software makers, Thai website managers, and others. And at the time I was writing this, there were four applications filed with the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control. These are four American companies that are filing for permission to invest in North Korea. So, because this is just in one paper and it's not an entire book, I've really only been able to touch on the companies that invested in there. But they invested for a variety of reasons in a variety of different fields, and for some reason they've decided that North Korea is worth the risk. But it's not really an argument for or against FDI here. I understand that some people say we need stronger sanctions, and some people say we need more engagement, and there's arguments whether this would extend the life of the regime or whether this perpetuates human rights violations. The thing is, the sanctions are in place now. The FDI is already there. So this isn't what should or should not happen. This is what's happening today. So what I'm interested in is what impact these have had and how we might be able to benefit from these individuals that make the personal decision to go in there and invest. So I tried to see how the work environment and how the industrial environment had changed. In 1999, the Euro-Asian Business Consultancy took a group of investors into North Korea. When they came back out, the then president of the consultancy group said that the investors took one look at the way North Korea operates and they will never come back. They did because North Korea has improved the investment environment. Now, there are a number of North Korean schemes. I mentioned the foreign investment groups and foreign investment companies, and then you've got the Korea Friendship Association. But there's also Phoenix Commercial Ventures, LNJ Development and Consultancy, Koryo Tours, GPI Consultancy, and these other private groups that take groups of potential investors into North Korea several times a year. So there is significantly more interest now than there was in 1999. Be that as it may, I don't want to overlook the fact that in the 2010 Index of Economic Freedom, North Korea got goose eggs for business freedom, trade freedom, fiscal freedom, monetary freedom, financial freedom, and labor freedom. So it's not a rosy picture. The report also said the Index of Economic Freedom report also said that property rights are not protected and there are many indicators of corruption in the government and security forces. So it's not very promising. It's also not entirely accurate. The very same survey also says that North Korean factory managers have had limited autonomy to set wages and offer incentives. That didn't happen 10 years ago. Since outside investment has begun, the North has seen development of, and from the report I quote, an immense informal market and informal trading with China in currency and goods is active. And as I said, a lot of most foreign banks will avoid North Korea because of all the debts and the defaults that it had back in the 70s and 80s. But there are aid agencies that have set up microcredit schemes for farmers and small businesses. The constitutional changes have been made that recognize market economic concepts because the regime has not only legitimized some commercial activity and markets, but it wants its cut. So it's taxing them. The right to ownership of means of production has been expanded, as has the right to engage directly in foreign trade, although that right to engage in foreign trade was reeled back in after the failed currency reforms at the end of last year, and I'm not sure where they stand right now. Criminal code has also been expanded. There are more laws punishing corruption, tax evasion, mismanagement, and other offenses against the government. And also, there are more protections for private property rights. The government's recognition of the need for laws like this is an indication that there's a growing range of anti-socialist behavior. Now, I don't know that FDI is directly responsible for all of that, but I can't overlook its influence. And I wonder how much further additional FDI could push marketization, capitalization, and the growth of individual self-interest in North Korea. Now, North Korea does have this habit of taking two steps forward and one step back. And a lot of these laws have been entered into the books, but at the same time, Kim Il-sung said it in 1958, and it still hasn't changed today. Laws are expressions of politics, hence subservient to politics, from which they can never be separated. So rule of law is still not word of the day in North Korea. FDI has played a role in decentralization of some decision making. Their labor markets, goods markets, currency markets in North Korea North Korea is now actively seeking more foreign capital to develop port facilities and industrial parks in Rajin, Nampo, Haeju, Chongjin, Wonsan, and Sinju, in addition to completing the second two phases of the Kaesong Industrial Complex and a new joint industrial zone with China along the Tumen River Delta. And I encourage this type of investment because I think that building a business infrastructure within North Korea encourages higher standards of law, higher standards of business, higher safety standards, higher standards of rights, and even just a higher standard of standardization. And all of these things can help North Korea to better engage with global society and the global economy. As I said, a number of investors have seen demonstrable improvement in the quality of their workforce, and part of this is due largely to the introduction of international standards of safety and production that they've been able to enforce. There is Swedish jeans manufacturer that invested in North Korea, and I mentioned this in my paper. They went in and said, yeah, we want to invest in this jeans factory, but our country only lets us invest if the factory meets our country's safety standards, which is just simply not true. But they thought it was an opportunity to ensure that there were high levels of high standards of safety in their factory, and rather than just argue about, you know, the benefits of that, they just lied and said, well, our government says we have to do that. And the North Koreans said, okay. And so that factory has seen a significant growth in production and a drop in safety violations and number of injuries. And these are the types of standards that FDI can help to support. And North Korea doesn't seem particularly adverse to improvements like this. They're allowing not only these ideas to come in with the investors, but they're trying to improve the environment in order to encourage more of these investors. Was it just the end of last month, the Pyongyang University of Science and Technology opened its doors? And this is the first privately owned or privately funded university in North Korea. But it's not just a privately funded university. It's funded by a Korean-American Christian missionary. You could not paint more of a wicked person for the Pyongyang regime. I mean, if they hate anybody, it's South Koreans, Americans, and Christian missionaries. And this guy is all wrapped up in one. And they let him go in there and develop a university that will be taught largely in English and largely from foreign professors. Now, it is a University of Science and Technology, and he has promised to build a large industrial park all around the university to provide jobs for all of his graduates. And that might have had some influence on the North Korean government's decision. But Chosun Exchange is a fairly new group, but they recently went to Pyongyang and taught some classes on finance. The Pyongyang Business School teaches international banking, international finance. The Asia Foundation, UN Development Program, the Nauman Foundation, the EBA, the Asia Development Bank, these and others all provide education and or educational materials. North Korea requests materials on international marketing and trade and commerce and finance and any number of other capitalist market-based economic classes. And so they're letting, you know, they're empowering their technocrats and their business leaders with these ideas that will help them better engage the international economy and therefore the international society. I think it's about all the time I've got, so I'll just wrap up by reiterating a paragraph that I pulled out of my paper. Let market-driven capitalistic private sector investment create an environment that encourages the North to establish rule of law and stable infrastructure in order to attract foreign investment, while the individual projects add to the knowledge base, introduce technologies and global standard operating procedures, and improve the standard of living one worker at a time by maintaining work environments that are acceptable by international society standards. Through investment, we can improve the lives of average North Koreans while also learning more about what goes on in one of the most reclusive countries in the world. So I'll end it there and open up to comments and questions, and look forward to hearing what everyone has to say.
Great. Thank you very much, Kevin. Thank you for that. We're going to open up the floor to questions, please raise your hand and I will recognize you. And there will be a microphone floating around, and so if you can wait for the microphone. But also, please, when you begin your question, please identify yourself, and please keep your questions brief so we can get as many questions in as possible. Thank you. So any questions? Drew.
Thank you. I'm Drew Thompson with the Nixon Center. Kevin, thank you. That's an excellent presentation. The burning question in my mind, and the theme throughout your paper, is that foreign investment in North Korea stimulates change. What I'm not certain about, and I'd love to get your sense, is that from the, I guess, Pyongyang regime perspective, is that change for the better or the change for the worse? Does this improve social stability, the regime's ability to survive through accumulating capital, improving incomes and nutritions amongst common people, or does it present sort of the what the Chinese feared in the mid-80s, sort of this peaceful evolution from within, the rise of a middle class? I don't have a good sense. I look at it one day and it could go entirely, wow, this could build regime resiliency. On the other hand, I think, wow, this could be its undoing. And that's kind of the fundamental question in North Korea. Can they afford to reform and open the way the Chinese keep pushing them to, or would that bring about their own collapse, and is that their fear? And then maybe one last sort of technical question. You gave a list of Europeans that are giving technical advice on market economies and finance. Are the Chinese doing anything similar?
We're going to do one question at a time?
Yeah.
All right. First, the Chinese do offer help, yes. In fact, many North Korean technocrats and authorities travel to China for training. I don't know how many Chinese go in to North Korea to provide training. It wouldn't surprise me to find out that it happened. But China not only trains North Koreans in China, but they also open up their industrial zones. And they take Kim Jong-il and his entourage around to show them the different sites and how these things are working and how they've improved. In fact, I'll share something that Drew pointed out to me last time I talked to him on this very point. The last time, when Kim Jong-il travels, it's almost always by train. Almost always by train. This last time, he got into China, got out of the train, and got into a car. And the Chinese made him travel around by car. Now, you mentioned that there's very good chances because the Chinese wanted to show them the big wide roads and the buildings along the roads and the development outside just that zone to make him see how it was benefiting the entire, the entire region. And so they're certainly pushing North Korea to adopt these reforms. But to your first question, can they afford to do this? I don't think they can afford not to. And I think they realize that, and they see the yin and the yang here, and they understand that's why it's two steps forward, one step back. And when it seems a little bit unstable, like it did after the failed currency reforms, you see them come back in and try to regulate markets and things like that because they understand, they do fear the same things as the Chinese fear. On the positive side, they saw that didn't completely wreck the Chinese. So they have learned from that, I think. It's still, for the North Korean regime, the ideal is a centrally planned economy that's run out of Pyongyang. I think they recognize that that's not possible. And so they're doing everything they can to open up without letting in these negative influences. And that's when they start with the industrial zones so that they can keep everything bottled in but still get the capital. When they get investment outside of the zones and investment from other groups, I think it's a very calculated decision whether or not the gains will outweigh the benefits will outweigh the costs. I think that I hope that it will be their undoing. A little bit at a time. I think some of the things we saw with the, you know, with resistance to market closures and things like that, I think that's a move towards what might end up becoming a wave that, you know, that they just lose control of. But we'll have to wait and see. They're certainly expecting that as well, doing everything they can to avoid it.
Thank you. My name is Sung Hee Na. I'm a consultant at the World Bank Group. Couple of comments and a question for you. On the animation thing, I don't know if you saw that news line a couple of days ago, yesterday, that Nelson Sheen had to explain or angrily respond to the reporters about the scene that was apparently shown on the recent, Simpsons episode that showed these Asian animation makers in a horrible working condition with the rats running around and things like that. And anyway, so, and I wonder if those scenes must have been thrown by somebody else, not obviously not North Korean workers. Other point on the PUST, P-U-S-T, Pyongyang University of Science and Technology, the chairman and founder of that university, I'm sure you are aware, also created YUST, Yanbian University of Science and Technology, and I believe he used that same model pretty much. And I know personally that he had been working on that project for over 10 years. He was, you know, has been here frequently for fundraising and all that, so including the teaching staff, they are trying to replicate what has successfully worked out at in China, at Yanbian. My question then is about Orascom. All the other projects appear to be relatively small scale. It might be, you know, most of them probably are being done in combination of some kind of assistance project with, some trade elements and things like that. Orascom definitely stands out in both its scope as well as scale. And with the financial transaction sanctions on the financial transactions with North Korea and the size of the investment, there has got to be a barter arrangement. I cannot imagine North Korea paying Orascom in any cash. And I wonder if you are aware of any kind of, the way it works, the return on the investment, recovery of their funds, whether there's any kind of significant scale kind of barter arrangement. Thank you.
All right, honestly, I did see the news about The Simpsons, and I didn't even click that was the same Nelson Shin. It didn't even register with me at the time, but I thought that was surprising, him having worked in animation in Asia, that he would depict it that way. But I don't know if he had a political message there or what, but that's up to him. The Orascom, I agree, it's very unique in scope and scale. I'm not entirely sure how North Korea is paying for all of that, but some of the money they've gotten has been from outside North Korea. For instance, their first big investment there was buying half of North Korea's largest cement factory. They've since sold that to a French company. So it's not all profit generated by North Korea. They're dealing with these businesses. The other two big projects that I know of that they have are trying to finish the disaster that is a hotel and their 3G network. The hotel is a gift, I think, to allow them to operate in the rest of the country. The return on the cell phone network, I think they're just looking very, very far in advance. I mean, they say they have over 300,000 subscriptions now So there's some money from that, not nearly enough to pay for a nationwide 3G network. But I think they're, you can probably put them in with that group of investors that are into speculation under the guise of a JV. And they're just looking toward the future with that, I think. I don't think they're expecting immediate returns. But I don't know if there's any barter or anything like that going on.
Next question.
Kevin, have you kept track of the Moon Sung-myeon investments? You know, some years back, he was very active going back and forth before the father died. And I know there's a building there, a religious center of some sort. It's called Center of Religious Activity or something. And they had a car company. And then I lost track of what became of those. Do you know?
The car company, Pyonghwa Motors, is still up and running. Another example of an inter-Korean joint venture. It is up and running, and it has... a monopoly. The problem is nobody has any money to buy cars. But it has a monopoly not only on the new car market, but Pyonghwa Motors has the rights to sell all used cars in North Korea. Most of the cars in North Korea are used cars from China or Japan. And those come and go with the whims of Kim Jong-il. There have been times where he's just said no more Japanese cars on the road. And then he lets them back out again. But so that kind of comes and goes. But Pyonghwa Motors still has the market. They're the only ones allowed to resell those cars. So they're still there. They crank out, I think it's less than 3,000 cars a year. But they have a very interesting website. I mean, you've all seen pictures of downtown Pyongyang, and it's even worse in the regional areas. You see the types of cars that are being driven around, 20, 30-year-old European, Chinese, and Japanese cars. Pyonghwa Motors actually has a website for the three models that they export. They're really spiffy looking cars. I have no idea who would buy one or if anyone has ever bought one from them. I'd be tempted to. I'm just torn between funding the regime and having such a unique car. But yeah, they're still up and running. As far as his religious center, I'm not sure where that is. It wouldn't surprise me that that's still going on. Because that was largely, you know, an aid-based type of thing. He was funneling money into North Korea. But I'm not sure.
Any other questions? Please, I'm going back.
This is Mario, visiting from CSIS Japan Chair. Thank you very much, Dr. Shepard. I have a related inquiry, if that's ready, about the Egyptian company Orascom. I'm very curious about the power and the effect of information network, and as far as I know, the first year North Korea introduced a cell phone network in downtown Pyongyang, and next year it will be expanded to the major cities in North Korea. If you had some updated information of that. And one more quick question is that recently one Japanese company in Osaka publishing a very interesting article called Imaging Gang. Many of that articles probably you know well, by ordinary North Koreans contributed to that magazine by using a cell phone, but it's not an Egyptian one, but the Chinese one. I'm afraid that the North Korean authority have already noticed that the side effect of an information network or cell phone network. How is your impression of the North Korean authority's recognition to the cell phone or information network? Thank you very much.
All right. First, the recognition of the side effects or the negative impacts of having cell phones, they're very aware of it. As you mentioned, these cell phones that are used to get information outside of the country are using, they're Chinese phones, and they're using Chinese relay stations. North Korea has tried to crack down on those at different times. I don't think that they have the manpower to do it full time, but there have been campaigns where they drive around through border regions with signal searchers of however it works. I don't know the technology, but trying to find cell phone signals and track down the people that are, because people will take their phone, go up in the mountains, make a phone call, get the information out, come back down, and the North Koreans are hunting for them, so they're certainly aware of it. On the other hand, one thing I thought was very interesting was when the first time that I heard about North Korea trying to track to crack down on these phones by trying to seek out the signals and trying to jam the signals. The Chinese built additional relay towers just on the Chinese side of the border. Now, China's aware that their traders are also going, when they're trading, that border is fairly porous. Again, it's not this hermetically sealed country at all. In fact, North Korea, just a week or two ago, I read an article that said North Korea had decided to allow North Koreans with family in China. They gave them permission to travel into China again. They had formed, after the currency reforms last year, they stopped that. And now they're letting these guys go back in. So there's a lot of cross-border traffic there, and the traders would use these phones. And so the Chinese government was saying, you know, if you're going to crack down, then we have to make sure that we're protecting our people. And so we're going to put up additional relay stations for the Chinese that are in North Korea, knowing full well that that was going to make the North Koreans' job much harder. The ORSCOM, yeah, you're right, it began in Pyongyang, then it spread out. I believe the plan, or the plan that they've released anyway, is to have it in every major city in the country by 2012. It's all tied into the strong and prosperous nation on the 100th anniversary of the birth of Kim Il-sung. But that network isn't connected with the outside world at all. Now, I don't know if North Korea thinks that if they make this type of access available to North Koreans, then they won't need the Chinese phones anymore, which I think would be a mistake for them to believe that. But this is certainly a way to show a level of technology to the people, saying, you know, we've come this far, and yet still maintain that pretty sharp, pretty hard grasp on the flow of information across borders by setting up their very own network that simply isn't compatible. This is not the first network that's been in North Korea. There was a Thai joint venture company that had a much smaller scale cell phone network in North Korea. But that was shut down with the train explosion, explosion near Kim Jong-il's train on return from North Korea a few years ago Yangon. North Korea shut down that phone network. There were rumors that it was a remotely triggered explosion using a cell phone, and that's why they had decided to shut down the entire cell phone scheme. I don't know if it's true or not. But now ORSCOM has gone in and setting this up, and that same Thai company, who apparently still had paper connections, this joint venture still existed, they want to get back in the game now. So there might even be competition in cell phones in North Korea. Yes, please.
Thank you. Dr. Shepherd, this is a rather general question.
I like those.
Okay. I understand that North Korea is serious about inviting foreign investment into their country. And I heard that they are sending their delegation, especially to European countries, to lure more investments. However, in view of the fact that they have done in the past 4 or 5 years, especially they did a nuclear test in 2006 and also in 2009, and in 2008, a South Korean tourist was killed by one of their soldiers at a Kumgang Mount Resort, which is one of their very biggest resources of foreign currency. And also, this year, March 2010, the Cheonam sinking. Is there a contradictory concept there? Why would they do such things which would not help them to provide more better environment for investments from the countries who are thinking of investing in their country? And why do they do it at the same time?
It's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Well, I don't think I would group those three things together, the nuke tests, the Kumgang shooting, and the Chonan. First, the Kumgang shooting. I believe it was an accidental shooting. The fuss and the end, what it amounted to, the end of that tourist scheme, was the fact that the North Koreans just wouldn't let South Korea go up there and investigate it. But I mean, if you've ever looked at the type of the military that's around there, it's a bunch of 18-year-old kids, and at 2 a.m, one of them didn't want to wake up his boss, and didn't want to let an intruder get away, and panicked and shot her in the back, and it was a very, very unfortunate accident. But I don't think it was part of a larger scheme to stir up any type of trouble, or I don't think there was any kind of order that came down from above for that. The nuclear tests are a different story. Of course, that's certainly part of a government plan. I think on one hand, they're running on several different tracks at the same time. They want to become a strong military, economic, and idealist power. And the ideology that the North Korean propaganda shows that they consider that they've successfully reached an ideologically strong nation, because Juche is still alive today. When the Soviet Union's fallen, the Cold War's over, Juche is still there, so they win. They've had two nuclear tests which solidify their militarily strong national status. That's for internal and external consumption, I believe. The nuclear tests do bring about additional sanctions that make it harder for some investors to go in. But these individual investors from the West don't seem too particularly bothered. I didn't run across anything anywhere where someone pulled out of an investment because of the nuclear test. Now, there have been some investments that have had trouble because North Korea is not the only end of it. You've got to have a market for whatever you're making there. There have been some companies that have had to close up shop in North Korea because their consumers were upset that they had ties with North Korea. I think the biggest example is British American Tobacco. They were operating there for quite some time before anybody found out about it, and then they were highly, highly criticized for having secretly, and making cigarettes in North Korea. And so they ended up shutting down operations. There have been some banks that pulled out because their customers didn't like it. So there is that aspect. But I didn't run across anyone who said, I was thinking about investing in North Korea, but then they had that nuke test. And there might be people that have done that. Certainly, if you look at the political risk of investment, that certainly makes it more politically risky to invest there. But again, I think North Korea was weighing benefits to cost, and they thought that the benefits to be gained through another nuclear test would outweigh the cost of these relatively small investments. The Chonan incident is beyond me. There are a lot of different ideas that I've heard that to some extent makes sense, and I think it's probably, if you take all the different reasons, I don't want to say that it's Kim Jong-un. Too many people say it's tied to succession. Well, Kim Jong-il is eventually going to die. Okay? So everything that happens is tied to succession. Everything. And if you read the newspapers, they'll tell you that, because every time anything happens, they tie it to succession. But and the best argument I've heard for tying the Chonan to succession isn't that it was Kim Jong-un that was responsible, or that it was Kim Jong-il that was responsible. It's that while Kim Jong-il is building up this base of support for Kim Jong-un, other people are vying for favor with the central regime. The same way Oh Guk-yeol and Chang Sung-taek are vying with investment. There could have been someone lower down in special forces or military that thought this would really show what a good comrade they are. And so in that way, it might have been tied to succession. But I don't know, and I don't have the inside information on all that. I do think that it set them back significantly with, you know, with investment and things of that nature. South Korea only cut back about 30%, but if you look at credit ratings, people were very, very concerned. If you look at what happened to the won immediately following that, people were very, very concerned about what that would do to stability on the peninsula. And so I do think that that hurt their investment, you know, their efforts to gain further investment. And I just think a lot of that can be tied to short-sightedness, and a lot of it can be tied to a lack of coordination between the different branches of the government.
Keith Krulak, State Department. Thank you very much. Very interesting paper. You just mentioned it again, and I flipped through your paper and I read the footnote. Could you talk anything more about this apparent competition between Changsungtech and Okunyol for investment? You don't really get into it much in the paper. I don't know if there's more you can talk about. Thanks.
Well, there's certainly no numbers out there, and it's just come through intelligence reports that have come out and through some defectors, but there are several trading companies. Ogukyul is directly in charge of the Korean International Trading Company, and it's run by the military and, you know, brings in foreign investment. Changsungtech chose the head of the Taepung International Investment Group, and that was just launched at the beginning of the year. And when it was launched, there was big talk about there was a bank that was to be associated with it. The Chinese were going to be going in, and I think the report said the Chinese were going to go in early March and sign a deal for $10 billion or something of that nature. As far as I know, it never happened. But Changsungtech is said to indirectly control that group. He chose the leader. The leader is loyal to him. It's one of the people inside his circle. And so both of them have been trying to raise more money than the other. And part of that is to look better. Now, they're both vice chairmen of the NDC. The first vice chairman of the NDC just died. I'm going to be very interested in seeing who replaces him, if it will be one of them, and if it will be because they, you know, they seemed like they were raising more money or they had a bigger group of supporters. There are some rumors that say that Kim Jong-un will just get thrown right in at the top. I don't think that's going to happen. But you know, right now, the two hold very similar positions in a government, and there's just been stories. Like I said, I don't have any numbers. There have been stories that the two of them are competing for investment through those two groups.
Thank you. My name is Ami from GG Press, a Japanese wire company. As you already mentioned, there are many companies from Europe or Asia which already started the business with North Korea. And my question is, how about the United States? And I found interesting information thanks to your report. It looks like there are four American companies which already submitted application to the Treasury Department to get permission to start investment. So my questions are two. What do you think, how much do American companies have niche in North Korea in the future if they're interested, if it's possible for them to start something? And second, is it possible for you to give more details about these four companies, if possible?
Four details, the best, without my research in front of me, that there was one consulting firm and the other three were all involved in mining or exploration. So I think there's one exploration company and two mining companies. And the consultancy was also somehow tied with underground resources and mining. So it's U.S. companies looking to get at North Korean natural resources, which they have very, very many of. The U.S. role, or what the U.S. niche might be, it's very hard for most U.S. companies to invest in North Korea, one, because of all the restrictions. the international and U.S. restrictions, and the fact that the majority of our economy is high-tech and service-oriented, and neither of those are going to work in North Korea. The companies that are investing in North Korea are, by and large, investing in labor-intensive, low-tech businesses, except for the mining sector and Orascom. And so we might see, wouldn't surprise me to see more U.S. companies involved in mining. But there are still a lot of restrictions. Like I said, you saw North Korean animation in The Lion King, but that was because Disney outsourced that to Disney Europe, and Disney Europe outsourced that to North Korea, because Disney U.S. can't do that. So there are all these restrictions, and there might be more U.S. companies that go that route through an offshore subsidiary or something of that nature. But by and large, you know, service industries aren't going to make much of a dent in the North Korean market, and high-tech companies have there's so many restrictions on the equipment that they'd be able to import. We've even seen that with South Korean companies in Kaesong before the Chonan incident, the biggest problem with advancing Kaesong Industrial Complex to the second and third phases is the level of technology that would have had to been imported. And at the moment, they're simply not able to legally import that type of stuff. There have been an argument some of those regulations should be lifted because the equipment is already in North Korea. It comes through China. You know, in Kaesong Industrial Complex, they couldn't install anything newer than, I think, a 286 computer. Right? But you look at these animation companies with their brand new Dells and they've got Microsoft graphics computers and things of that nature, but it's all coming through China. South Korean companies and American companies that want to actually follow the law can't import that type of stuff. So I don't think there'll be a big market for U.S. companies.
A couple more questions.
Hello, Kevin. Thank you for coming. My name is Elaine Tassinari. I'm an attorney in international law with a practice in private and public international law. Your paper highlights were very enlightening to me today. I was not aware that there were so many foreign companies directly investing in North Korea, especially with all the UN sanctions. I was glad to hear this gentleman's remarks on the provocative acts recently over the past couple of years, the nuclear testing and whatnot. I'm surprised. I would like to hear you speak more about the consumer complaints, what the market is, and how the investors are dealing with that as far as who would be their consumers. That's what I'm curious about. Also, similarly, how are their investors in those boards of investors or whatnot, in those companies themselves, dealing with reconciling the fact that there are sanctions against human rights violations and whatnot in North Korea? And also, I was concerned, as an attorney with some human rights experience, are these companies, when they invest in and work in North Korea, are they negotiating compliance with North Korea to adhere to some international norms in human rights and labor law standards? What kind of oversight would there be for that? They're not a member of the WTO or any larger, world forum organization where anyone could make sure that they would be held accountable in some way. I'm curious what your research showed about that. Thank you.
All right. It's an interesting question, and just before I came in here, we were in Ambassador Pritchard's office, and he showed me a book, and he says it's a little outdated because they're constantly updating. But it was a book about this thick of North Korean investment law. They've enacted quite a few laws to protect investments and to regulate money inflows and outflows and to regulate their workers. And surprisingly, now I'm not, please don't take me wrong and think that I'm pretending like there aren't human rights violations in North Korea. Of course there are. It turns out, though, that the workers in these foreign companies are actually not only treated better by the foreign managers than they are by Korean managers, they're protected more by the North Korean government than workers in North Korean factories are. I mean, look at the Kaesong Industrial Complex. And in order to employ more workers, North Korea regulates the number of hours they're allowed to work. Tells South Korean companies you cannot work them more than X amount of hours. If you want to keep your factory running, you have to hire more people. You have to provide their health care. North Korea doesn't want to pay for their health care. South Korea has built a hospital there. Well, they're getting better health care because it's a South Korean hospital than they would be if they were going to a North Korean hospital. Wages that are set for foreign firms by the North Korean government are set higher than the wages that North Korean workers in North Korean factories are getting. So just by the fact that the North Korean government understands that it can exploit this foreign government or this foreign investor more than it, you know, more to an extent greater than it would want to pay to protect or treat workers in one of its own factories, means that they have, the workers in those factories have higher standards of living. Also, some of the investors, I mentioned the gene manufacturer, some of the investors have also stated they've required certain standards, certain safety standards, certain production standards and things of that nature, which also help to improve the lives of at least those few workers that are directly involved in that company. The markets and the consumer complaints you mentioned, it varies. For the South Korean investment, the market is almost entirely in South Korea for things made in Kaesong Industrial Complex. For the tourists that would go to Kumgang Mountain before the shooting in 2008, 90-something percent, I would say, for South Korean market. And there's not a lot of complaint in the South Korean market about that investment. That's the investment into North Korea and expansion of inter-Korean joint ventures and economic cooperation and improvement in inter-Korean relations is generally supported in South Korea. Some of the complaints, like I said, the BAT, that's an international, you know, company. I'm not sure where the complaints are coming from, but I found several newspaper articles that were criticizing BAT for having secretly invested in North Korea. And I think most of the criticism was that they had done it and not told anyone, not that they had done it. But I don't know what would have happened if they had publicly announced at the very beginning that they were going to invest there, whether people would have criticized them the same way or not. But for the European investment, it's also fairly varied. The Chinese investment, almost all in mining, and for 50 years, it's all going to be taken out and used in China. Russia and China investing in the ports so that they can have a warm water port. Now, I don't know if we wait long enough, then global warming might solve that for Russia. But at the moment, Vladivostok still freezes over. And so there's not really a product there. But their investment, there's no product and there's no end user other than shipping companies, and there's no complaint about having that open. For the Europeans, some of the factories are selling clothing and especially the clothing and the shoes and textiles of that nature. Those are being sold back in European markets. The pharmaceutical company is selling mainly in North Korea, within North Korea. So it varies. You're right that there's not a lot of oversight when North Korea agrees to a certain standard. The only person overseeing that is the foreign manager in that business. And to what extent they can enforce it, I think it varies in case-to-case basis. But North Korea does seem to have shown a recognition that it needs to abide by these rules and laws that it set in order to encourage further investment. That's only for the foreign investments. Those are not standards that are flowing over into North Korean factories. Will it someday? I don't know. When someone comes home from working in a factory from a foreign investor that had safety standards and free lunches and free vaccinations and things like that, and they talk to their family that's working in a North Korean factory, what impact that has on the rest of those people wanting to find a job in a foreign company, what you know, how empowered they would be to take a job in a foreign company, or how North Korea selects those people, I don't know. But I don't see it having a negative impact. How much of a positive impact it will have is very hard to measure. And how do the people on the boards reconcile North Korean human rights with the opportunity to turn a profit? The same way they've done it for years when they invest in sweatshops anywhere else. It's the opportunity to turn a profit for most of them. I think that's all of your questions. Did I miss anything?
Okay. Well, Kevin, thank you very much for your enlightening presentation, taking our questions. Please help me thank Kevin by...